The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. Hello and welcome to the Ocean Mist Power Hour. I am your hostess, Misty Young. And I've had an awful lot of fun over these first 34 weeks of the Ocean Mist Power Hour. Before we get started today, I do want to let you know I have decided not to continue to do the Ocean Mist Power Hour after my 52 weeks are up. So you're the first to hear it. Well, you're the second to hear it. Maybe the third or fourth, because I told my husband first and a couple other people. But I've had a fabulous time right here on the Ocean Mist Power Hour. And I've decided it's time to move on. So I will produce another 18 episodes. That will bring me to a full year of 52 episodes. It's been a blast. And then I'm going to move on. Now, before we do, let me welcome you to Brookings Harbor right here on KCIW 100.7 FM on your radio dial. This is Curry Coast Community Radio, and we're broadcasting out of Brookings Harbor, Oregon. I like to call this the gateway of the Great Pacific Northwest. It's about as far west as you can get in the continental U.S. It's not as far as you can get west, because that's up near Port Orford somewhere. It is the home of daffodils and December flowers all year round, and truly the nicest people you'll ever meet. This is where the mountains and the old-growth redwoods meet the sea. Brookings and Harbor particularly is home to me. Before we get started, I'd like to thank the KCIW sound engineering and production crew and the board of directors of this incredibly awesome little radio station. The little radio station that could, the little radio station that did, the little radio station that is. And before I start in today, and you're going to be shocked, we're not talking about nutrition today. That's right. We're talking about all kinds of other topics. I want to tell you that if you've enjoyed the Ocean Mist Power Hour, and if you haven't enjoyed it, that's okay too. But if it's given you any sense of, hey, maybe I could do a radio show, guess what? You could. It's an awful lot of fun. Really and truly, it's fun. You get to come into the studio. You get to learn how to do broadcast. You get to pick topics, talk to people if you want, create interviews or read materials that you've got permission to do. You know, most of the time we do Dr. Greger's material from nutritionfacts.org. But we also have permission and use permission-based materials from the Brookings Institution and also from theconversation.com. There's tons of material, tons of resources that you can share with other people if you use the radio to do it. It's a blast. I would encourage you, if you've thought about it at all, give it a try. Connect with the folks at KCIW, and you can find them on kciw.org, and just fill out the I want to be a producer form. You know, tell them you want to have a radio show, and you fill out a little form, and the board of directors checks it out. They check you out. They decide if it fits with their programming, their goals. And then if they decide that they want you to come on board, guess what? It's a lot of fun, really and truly. So today we're going to talk about all kinds of topics, just a wide variety, a virtual compendium of topics, okay? And we're going to start with some information from The Conversation. Now, The Conversation is a cool website. It is an amazing place where you can get information from journalists and researchers that are looking at topics across the spectrum from arts and culture to environment and energy, economy, business, science, technology, religion, health, medicine. There's so many areas that they're looking at. And just like the Brookings Institution, they are an independent think tank type organization. And I would encourage you to take a look at them on theconversation.com. They like to say that they are academic rigor with journalistic flair. Woohoo! So today we're going to talk about an article. The first one we're going to read is American Youth Don't Know Much About the Juvenile Justice System. What? Is that so strange? We're going to take such a wide turn from what we normally do. Yeah. You know why? Because that's kind of how I am. I like to give myself a lot of permission to do whatever I want in life. And, you know, that means sometimes I'm studying nutrition, which is pretty much all the time. And sometimes I'm looking at arts and culture, and sometimes I'm looking at the juvenile justice system. It doesn't matter. I have a wide variety of interests, and I like to share them, and I like to just do my own thing, whatever that might be. And so today we're going to talk about young people in the U.S. So check this out. This article, American Youth Don't Know Much About the Juvenile Justice System. Let's see who the author is on this one. This one doesn't have an actual author. Isn't that weird? Did I get it? No. Oh, yeah, there's three authors. Here they are. So sorry about that. Tammy Chang, who is an assistant professor of family medicine at the University of Michigan. Omar Elias, he is a research associate at Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation at the University of Michigan. And Vic Weiner, who is a law student at the College of Law, University of Tulsa. So there is a disclosure statement here. Tammy Chang receives funding from the National Institutes of Health. And Omar and Vic do not work for, consult, own shares in, or receive funding from any company or organization that would benefit from this article and have disclosed no relevant affiliations beyond their academic appointment. Okay? So here we go. American youth don't know much about the juvenile justice system. Young people in the U.S. who end up in the juvenile justice system often leave the system much worse than when they entered. But American youth know little to nothing about the juvenile justice system that would determine their future if they were ever accused of committing a crime. Our team surveyed nearly 1,000 teens and young adults across the country to gain insight into their perceptions of the system. We found that many have limited knowledge or are conflicted about its purpose. Juvenile justice in the U.S. The most common way a young person enters the juvenile justice system is through an encounter with police. In the U.S., an estimated 1.6 million people under the age of 18 are arrested each year. Those who are arrested are disproportionately male and of a minority race. Larceny, simple assault, drug abuse violations, and disorderly conduct offenses account for half of all juvenile arrests. In correctional facilities, youth may experience overcrowding, physical and sexual violence, or trauma. Incarceration of youth in prison or other correctional facilities has been linked to academic failure, disengagement from school, disciplinary problems, and adult incarceration. Adults with a history of juvenile justice involvement are more likely to have depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, and suicide attempts compared to those without involvement. Little to no knowledge. My Voice is a national poll that collects the opinions of 14 to 24-year-olds across every state in the U.S. In February, through My Voice, we asked youth a series of questions about what they know about the U.S. juvenile justice system. For example, we asked, when youth commit a crime, the juvenile justice system determines what happens to them. What do you know about this system? 56% said they knew little to nothing. That's similar to what adults say they know about the adult criminal justice system. One said, I know very little. I know about juvenile detention from shows like iCarly. Another said, mostly I know what I have seen in TV shows and movies, which I question the accuracy of. Otherwise, I know a small bit from media like news. I'm not even sure what the age is to charge someone through the juvenile system versus the adult system, added another. Many young people also recognized their limited knowledge as a problem. As one said, I don't know a lot, but I feel like I should learn more. According to a 2018 report from a youth advocacy project at the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia, youth not only enter the system with little knowledge of it, but are often kept in the dark once in the system. I wasn't aware that I would be going to prison and was being tried in adult court, wrote Naiji, one youth who has been involved in the juvenile justice system. On my way to court, right before I got there, my worker told me I was not going home. They did not tell me how long I was staying. I was 14. I didn't know anything, wrote another youth named Alex. Conflicted over its purpose. My Voice data indicate that not only are youth uneducated about the system overall, but are conflicted on what should happen to a young person if they were to enter this system. According to the U.S. government, the purpose of the juvenile justice system is rehabilitation, developing skills, addressing treatment needs, and successful reintegration of the youth into the community. In our survey, 65% stated that the purpose of this system should primarily be to rehabilitate, educate, or prevent future criminal behavior. At the same time, 56% thought youth who commit a crime should be charged or punished. Now, there are graphs in here, and I want you to realize that anytime I'm reading something to you through theconversation.com, if there's something you question, you can go to theconversation.com and you can read the article yourself. Remember, this is called American Youth Don't Know Much About the Juvenile Justice System. You could just type that into the search bar at the top of theconversation.com. In fact, I want to encourage you to just get out there and explore information on theconversation.com. Don't waste your time cruising around and just clicking randomly on YouTube and Google. Don't be random in your learning and growth. Be intentional and diligent in your growth and learning. And maybe you're not interested in the juvenile justice system. That's okay. Remember the topics that we talked about earlier on theconversation.com, the areas they study: arts and culture, economy and business, education, environment, energy, ethics, religion, health, medicine, politics, society, science and technology. These kind of topics are fascinating. And it's not just like you click on there and there's one article. There's dozens of articles, hundreds of articles on theconversation.com that are fascinating and have deep links to other meaningful, relevant, scholarly-based information. Most of us are involved with fake news on a day-to-day basis. Don't do that. Why would you do that to yourself? Why do you even watch TV? Uh-oh, here comes a rant. Here it comes. Do you watch TV? Do you watch news on TV? Golly, someone I love, I've discovered that I can't rat out my family members too much. So I'm just going to say one of my family members that I love very, very much told me a couple days ago, "Well, you know, honey, my TV's on all day long. I don't watch it or anything. It's just on in the background for background." Oh, right. With shows like Judge Judy and Dr. Phil. And I don't even know what's on daytime TV. Half the time when I walk into that house, CNN is blaring rape and murder and robbery and gross, ugly, disgusting stuff like that. Like, why? Why would you put that into your brain? Okay, rant over. Remember, you can go to theconversation.com and you can choose what you put in your brain. You don't have to have the TV on, okay? Rant continuing. You do not have to have the TV on all day, every day, any day, ever. You never have to turn it on. And if you do turn it on, what if you turned it on intentionally to something specific that you wanted to watch? Not just random TV junk blaring at you all day, every day. And then, oh my gosh, how about all the commercials and the stuff they want to sell you and the garbage they want you to put in your body, whether it's on one end, the health and nutrition end, right? Oh, I think, you know, Fruit Loops are healthy. No, they're not. And then on the other end, they've got all these diabetes medications and heart medications and this and that. Okay, rant over. Officially for this moment, the rant is over. See, this is why I can't do radio anymore, because I get too fired up. I am opinionated, okay? In case you hadn't noticed that by now, being here on the Ocean Mist Power Hour, dude, I'm just like, I get out of control and I get fired up. And when I left this morning, my husband said, "Rant out on the universe," right? I was like, you know it, I'm gonna do it. Because you know what? We're all the same way, right? We're all more alike than we are different. This is true. This is just straight up true. We're all more alike than we are different. You know, you put your hand on your heart. Your heart's a lot more like my heart than it is different. Doesn't matter if we have different views or policies or politics or religion or anything. We're more alike than we are different. So you rant too. Maybe you don't rant out loud. Maybe you don't rant on the radio. Maybe you stuff your rants down inside and keep them in you. Ew, gross. Ew, why would you do that? Let your rants out. Get them out. Tell you what, there's some places here where we can go and we can just rant to the forest. All by yourself if you need to. You can just get out there and rant to the forest. You can rant in a canyon. You could rant to the ocean. You might look a little crazy doing it. You could get on a radio show and be certifiably crazy doing it. All right, rant now officially over. Back to the conversation. Many young people in the My Voice study displayed conflicting thoughts about the juvenile justice system. One 17-year-old mentioned that the goal of the system should be to reform the children, but that youth who entered the juvenile justice system should be punished. Another agreed that the goal should be to reform, not incarcerate, maybe through a program that treats them like human beings. I'll tell you who ought to treat them like human beings is their parents. I'm sick of seeing parents arm-grabbing their kids in the market. "Come over here right now. Get over here. Arm grab." Like, dude, kindness and compassion starts at home, with us, to our kids, to our grandkids, to ourselves and our others. That's where kindness and compassion starts. If we're rude and overbearing and awful to our kids at home, don't we think they might end up in the juvenile justice system? Kids crave attention. They'll crave negative attention if they can get it. What about better education? These responses highlight the need for reliable and accessible resources that can help young people better understand the juvenile justice system. There is no set curriculum for what youth ought to know, but there are elements in the life of youth, such as missing school or partying, that could get them mixed up in the juvenile justice system under offenses such as truancy, underage drinking, or curfew violation. If youth better understood the juvenile justice system, they would be more equipped to navigate the system and advocate for programs and policies that could benefit them. The voices of young people in our study demonstrate a gap where education and greater visibility can help move what is happening in the juvenile justice system out of the shadows. Nobody wants to see kids in juvenile justice systems, do we? Nobody wants that. Nobody wants it. It's terrible. It's an awful place for kids to be. If you're a parent with young kids, or if you're a grandparent, can you read books to your kids? You know, my poor kids, they loved being read to. And I didn't read them fairy tales. I was not a fairy tale grandmother. Those kids were listening to Deepak Chopra when they were 7. I'm not kidding you. Zen and the Art of Motorcycles? You bet, when they were 7. The Holographic Universe? Absolutely, you bet, when they were 9 and 2. Like, I read them these books, The 7 Spiritual Laws of Success, The Seed of the Soul. I read them these books because I felt like giving them an intentional, specific role model of information that could help them develop and grow was better than what they were going to find on the Transformers or the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, where everything on TV for kids is about somebody's getting bullied and somebody calls a name and then somebody comes up and defeats the enemy. Come on. That's just junk for kids. Boy, I'm on the rant today, I'll tell you what. All right, next article. California is living America's dystopian future. What the heck? The Golden State is on fire, which means that an idea of American utopia is on fire too. Utopias are the good places of our imagination, while dystopias are the places where everything goes terribly wrong, where evil triumphs and nature destroys her own. Frequently, utopias and dystopias are the same place because perfection may not be possible without someone suffering. Now remember, we're looking at theconversation.com. We're reading an article called California is Living America's Dystopian Future, and this is written by the author Stephanie Le Manager, professor of English literature right here, hometown girl, University of Oregon. Disclosure statement says that Stephanie Le Manager does not work for, consult, own shares in, or receive funding from any company or organization that would benefit from this article and has disclosed no relevant affiliations beyond their academic appointment. Woohoo! And I love that this one is coming from the University of Oregon. I love our university. So we said that frequently utopias and dystopias are the same place because perfection may not be possible without someone suffering. Ursula Le Guin writes about this paradox in something called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. This is a story about the moral dilemma of living in a city called Omelas, whose prosperity is made possible by one child's pain. There's a link to that. So if you wanted to go and read this story, evidently you can go right to that story or you can read more about it. As the story's title makes clear, most people don't walk away from the beautiful place, even when its secret is known. California often finds itself the Omelas of the American imagination. For some, it's the beautiful place where having it all means shafting someone else, as in Roman Polanski's Chinatown, about Los Angeles' theft of water from the Owens Valley. Oh man, that's such an ugly thing that they did. Or as in the magical theme park Disneyland, which substantially underpays some of its workers. Whoopsie. The novelists Octavia Butler, Eden Lepucki, Carl Taro Greenfield, Paolo Bagicolpi, and Claire V. Watkins are among the many who have imagined The Golden State as a dystopian novel. In their novels, California is either on fire, in extreme drought, or both. They all picture California's descent as a combination of climate crisis and social unrest. Now, there's a read more in here, and I want you to go check it out if you're interested. Remember, we're in the conversation, California is Living America's Dystopian Future. There's a click here that you can go to Silicon Valley, From Heart's Delight to Toxic Wasteland. Ooh, see, that kind of stuff's fascinating. Like, you just go down the rabbit hole, right? Like, what do you mean California's on fire? Well, for these authors we just mentioned, climate change hints at the dark secret of the perfect place, of bad decisions that all America shares. Their novels suggest that if California looks like a dystopia before other American places, that's because it's often in the lead. Interesting. California is America fast forward, sociologist Manuel Pastor says. Ecology of fear. The wildfires that ravage California light up America's screens with terror. There's that TV again. Suburban homes are stripped to their foundations. Samaritans lead horses from burning barns. The historian Mike Davis reminds us that California has long seemed an ecology of fear for Euro-Americans. Settlers from Northern Europe and the East Coast did not understand Southern California's climate, which is prone to unpredictability and drought. I totally grew up in Southern California, so this next statement is a crack up. Here's the quote. This is seriously funny. Southern California is Walden Pond on LSD, Davis writes, meaning that is a psychedelic version of American nature spots like Walden Pond in New England. That's hysterical. The unfamiliarity of California's climate led to poor decisions about where to build from the start. Totally, totally, totally true. I mean, Southern California houses are built on cliffs, and we have earthquakes down there. They're built in canyons that are rife with floods and fires. It's kind of crazy. Now, Californians, like most Western Americans, live too close to their wildlands, which are drying into tinderboxes. In the United States, there are now more than 46 million single-family homes, several hundred thousand businesses, and 120 million people living and working in and around the country's forests, writes the journalist Edward Struzik in Firestorm, which is his book about how wildfire will shape our future. It's kind of weird, isn't it, this whole wildfire thing? I mean, we think back to just a few summers ago when we had the Chetco Bar fire. And all of us, it was scary. I mean, we're right here in Oregon, and yeah, we have houses on the cliffs, and we're right up next to the forest, and we're in the canyons, and we have earthquakes here, too. We just had a couple last week. You know, this isn't just California is a dystopian future. Remember what everybody used to say decades ago in here in Oregon? They said, don't Californicate Oregon. That was always so funny. And frankly, in California, when I was growing up, Californians used to say, welcome to California, leave your beautiful daughters, and now go home. That's so terrible, but I'm telling you the truth. I grew up down there. I mean, it was the LSD of like Walden Pond. It was crazy. America has created the combustible environment called intermix, where residential and commercial uses spill into wildlands. America craves inexpensive electricity too, which means that overhead power lines run through forests and chaparral. Overhead lines have sparked some of the worst recent fires in California and other places like New Mexico and Tennessee. California utility company PG&E estimates the cost for converting overhead to underground lines to be US $3 million per mile. While cost estimates vary, such a project surely will be expensive and might take a century to complete. Overhead infrastructure wasn't made for extreme weather, like the estimated 80-mile-per-hour winds that inspired a rare extreme red flag warning in Southern California. You know, this kind of stuff bugs me, right? Because do taxpayers support? I'm pretty sure there's tax dollars that go to support companies like PG&E, right? There's some underwriting and subsidies and all of that stuff. That's tax dollars. And then we have these other people over there called shareholders. Oh, the shareholders, they need their money too. So the public pays and helps to support this stuff, building distribution and generation and helping to support the power, and then the shareholders get to take the profits out of it while the frickin' taxpayer is still there holding the bill and watching their houses burn down. Wow. Ugh. Pleasure in the state's demise? On Fire, California is a dystopian novel that the rest of America reads avidly and at times with Schadenfreude, that feeling of joy that a person may take in another's suffering. Weird, huh? California ranks as one of the happiest states in the U.S. at number 13. but California came last in a 2012 poll on which states Americans like. Isn't that interesting? Happiness factor number 13, last in the number of states that Americans like. That's crazy. Maybe it's the happiness that annoys others, which some perceive as phony. They seriously say tofu, silicone, and dyed hair, said Senator Ted Cruz in 2018 about what is wrong with California. And here's a tweet from Donald J. Trump. There is no reason for these massive, deadly, and costly forest fires in California, except that forest management is so poor. Billions of dollars are given each year with so many lives lost, all because of gross mismanagement of the forests. Remedy now. No more federal payments. Now, look, I don't talk politics on this show. I don't. I'm not into politics. But I'll tell you what, I'm sick of tax dollars funding. Oh man, I want to say BS so bad I'm saying it. Shaving cream is what I'm saying. We fund shaving cream, bull shaving cream all the time. We're funding it. $600 toilets and $1,000 hammers and gross mismanagement of the forests where people die. Give me a break. It's terrible. As taxpayers, you know, there's all these rebellions happening around the world right now for climate change, which I'm so mad about climate change. I mean, it's here and I'm completely distraught. I don't even know what to do about it anymore. I'm doing my best. I'm driving an electric car. I'm recycling as much as possible. I don't fly very much anymore. I used to fly. I just don't anymore. I don't even take vacations. I own a freaking timeshare in Kauai, and guess what? I'll probably never go there again. Why? Because I'm doing my part. And we all have to do our part. And the taxpayers shouldn't be funding any of this stuff. It's shaving cream. I'm telling you, it's shaving cream. Oh, man. When California was on fire in 2018 with thousands missing and dozens dead, President Donald Trump tweeted that the state mismanaged its forests. He tweeted the same thing during the recent fires with more force. Schadenfreude? Arguably, the nation is struggling to address the fire challenges of the intermix, and California is ahead of the rest. California supposedly is most hated by conservatives, but it nurtured the careers of conservative icons Ronald Reagan and Rush Limbaugh, plus a pair of conservative ballot measures, Prop 13 and Proposition 187, that cut taxes as well as services to immigrants. It is also the birthplace of modern progressive movements from the United Farm Workers to environmentalism. California has been a seedbed of American political passions to the right and the left. Perhaps that's why it arouses passion and envy. Confronting the secret. Dystopian thought criticizes what it loves in an attempt to make it better. If California is living a dystopian novel, it is also a first responder to the fires of a changing planet. Some of the state's utility companies are getting smarter about infrastructure fixes. Evacuations are going better in the places where evacuations happened before. Californians voted in a landmark cap-and-trade bill to curb greenhouse gas emissions, and now they're trying to improve on it. Yay, verily, that's awesome. The state's climate policy and renewed support for investment in public education signal that it is getting past the nation's racial generation gap, where older white voters don't see themselves in a demographically browner youth and resist funding them. Wow, that always bugged me too, you know, like all these people that become grandparents. Maybe it's all of us right here in Brookings, or who knows where you're listening, anywhere in the world. Thanks for tuning in to the Ocean Mist Power Hour. Thanks for listening on KCIW 100.7 FM on your radio dial. Glad you're here. Isn't it weird that, you know, young people are like, we want our money, we want to fund schools and taxes, we got to have education for our children, and then they turn gray, or as I like to call them, Q-tippers. They turn into Q-tippers, and the Q-tippers are like, we don't want to put any more money into the school system. Oh, really? Like, come on now. Your kids got to go through, and now we need, you know, to upgrade the school system, and now taxes can't go because you're old now, and you don't want your taxes to go for that? Give me a break. Come on. We can't resist funding kids, especially because this is interesting. Let's read this again. The state's climate policy and renewed support for investment in public education signal that it is getting past the nation's racial generation gap, where older white voters don't see themselves in a demographically browner youth and resist funding them. I'm glad to know that Californians are beginning to get beyond that. You know, we can't see ourselves in a browner youth. Didn't you hear earlier? We're all more alike than we are different. So some people have black hair. Some people have brown hair. Some people have white hair. The guy sitting across the table from me has absolutely pristine white and silver hair. It's gorgeous. I have a lot of gray in my hair. My best friend's hair is absolutely jet black, like Sharpie marker black. It's so pretty. Living in Omelas means either compromising with injustice or learning how to make the world better before others even know that it's broken. Stay tuned, this author says. Wow, I love that idea that Californians may be moving beyond this idea that they can't see themselves in the browner youth, the new majority coming up. I remember being in sociology class. Gosh, it must have been, I started college in 1988 and I took a sociology class in 1988. I was considered an older returning student at the ripe age. I think I was 26 when I started college. And my professor, I loved him so, so much. Birch was his name. Birch Berberoglu. I never knew how to say his last name. He always just said his name was Birch. And he had a really thick accent. He was from, where was Birch from? I think he was from Hungary. And he used to say, he's like, it's coming. It's coming in the future. You're going to see it in the future. You're going to see it. The white people, they will not be the majority. They'll not be. I'm doing my best Birch, you know, impersonation, but I'm not very good at it. But he did. He said, he goes, look, in 30 years or so, he goes, America's going to look a lot different. White people are going to be the minority. You know what? How about we just all say we're all more alike than we are different and that the skin color doesn't matter? That would be like discriminating against people because they don't have the same hair color as you. Hello? Nobody does that. Do they? God. All right. TheConversation.com. We're going to look at an article called 11,000 Scientists Warn Climate Change Isn't Just About Temperature. This is written by Thomas Newsom, who's a lecturer at the University of Sydney, and William Ripple, who is a distinguished professor and director of Trophic Cascades Program at Oregon State University. Hey, hey, woohoo, another Oregon right there in the mix. And actually, it's kind of cool because the very first story I read to you, we shared about the juvenile justice system, had a photo in it. There was a graphic in there that showed rogue juvenile justice system something. There was a rogue campus in there. It's kind of cool. Another. So all three so far have had something to do mentioning Oregon. So this says exactly 40 years ago, a small group of scientists met at the world's first climate conference in Geneva. They raised the alarm about unnerving climate trends. 40 years ago. So this article was written and published. When was this published? I think that I saw that it was published in November. Yeah, it was just published a couple days ago, November 5th, 2019. Wow, 40 years ago. I was 17 then. I was 17 40 years ago when a small group of scientists met at the world's first climate conference in Geneva. They raised the alarm about unnerving climate trends. Today, more than 11,000 scientists have co-signed a letter in the journal Bioscience calling for urgently necessary action on climate. This is the largest number of scientists to explicitly support a publication calling for climate action. They come from many different fields, reflecting the harm our changing climate is doing to every part of the natural world. And there is a really good click in here. I want you to look at it. 40 years ago, scientists predicted climate change. And hey, they were right. So if you wanted to go read this article, it's on theconversation.com. 11,000 scientists warn climate change isn't just about the temperature. And this click is on the first page above the fold. Why no change? If you're thinking not much has changed in the past 40 years, you might be right. Globally, greenhouse gas emissions are still rising with increasingly damaging effects. Much of the focus to date has been on tracking global surface temperatures. This makes sense as goals like prevent 2 degrees Celsius of warming create a relatively simple and easy to use or easy to communicate message. However, there's more to climate change than global temperature. In our paper, we track a broader set of indicators to convey the effects of human activities on greenhouse gas emissions and the consequent impacts on climate, our environment, and society. The indicators include human population growth, tree cover loss, fertility rates, fossil fuel subsidies, oh, hate subsidies, glacier thickness, and frequency of extreme weather events all are linked to climate change. Troubling signs over the past 40 years. Profoundly troubling signs linked to human activities include sustained increases in human and ruminant populations. Ruminants are those kind of animals that have multiple stomachs, you know, cows, guys that eat, they're the guys that eat grasses. I think goats are considered ruminants too. Global tree cover loss, fossil fuel consumption, number of plane passengers, and carbon dioxide emissions. The concurrent trends on the actual impacts of climate change are equally troubling. Sea ice is rapidly disappearing, and ocean heat, ocean acidity, sea level, and extreme weather events are all trending upwards. These trends need to be closely monitored to assess how we are responding to the climate emergency. Any one of them could hit a point of no return, creating a catastrophic feedback loop that could make more regions of Earth uninhabitable. Here's a click I want you to look at. What climate tipping points should we be looking out for? Maybe we'll look at that one when we're done with this article. Maybe not. The need for better reporting. We urge national governments to report on how their own results are trending. Our indicators will allow policymakers and the public to better understand the magnitude of this crisis, track progress, and realign priorities to alleviate climate change. Some of the indicators could even be presented monthly to the public during news broadcasts, as they are arguably more important than the trends in the stock exchange. Wow! That is just absolutely mind-blowing to me. I have to read that again. You know, I barely have a tiny little portfolio in the stock market, but I kind of check it a lot because it's fun. I mean, it's tiny, but I check it. But did you hear what this guy just said? Some of the indicators could even be presented monthly to the public during news broadcasts, as they are arguably more important than the trends in the stock exchange. What could be more important to people than their money? Well, how about the house is on fire? Hello? We are not going to be able to live here much longer, although this does say it's not too late to act. In our paper, we suggest six critical and interrelated steps that governments and the rest of humanity can take to lessen the worst effects of climate change. Number one, prioritize energy efficiency and replace fossil fuels with low-carbon renewable energy sources. Number two, reduce emissions of short-lived pollutants like methane and soot. Number three, protect and restore the Earth's ecosystems by curbing land clearing. Number four, reduce our meat consumption. Boy, that's close to my heart. Number five, move away from unsustainable ideas of ever-increasing economic and resource consumption. And finally, number six, stabilize and ideally gradually reduce human populations while improving human well-being. We recognize that many of these recommendations are not new, but mitigating and adapting to climate change will entail major transformations across all six areas. How can you help? Individuals can make a difference by reducing meat consumption, voting for political parties and members of government bodies who have clear climate change policies, rejecting fossil fuels where possible, using renewable and clean sources of energy, reducing car and air travel, and joining citizen movements. Lots of small changes will help inspire larger scale shifts in policy and economic frameworks. We are encouraged by a recent global surge of concern. Some governments are declaring climate emergencies. Grassroots citizen movements are demanding change. As scientists, we urge widespread use of our indicators to track how changes across the six areas above will start to change our ecosystem trajectories. Wow. You know, I'm always feeling distraught about the climate. And I've never been a conspiracy theorist. It just doesn't fit with kind of my mindset. And I don't know that there's a conspiracy here, but I feel absolutely distraught about the climate. I just totally do. I don't see a way out. I really don't. I see people just barreling forward, eating meat, cheese, milk, dairy products, sour cream, ice cream, butter, chicken, turkey, ham, bacon, sausage, pigs, pork, lamb, tuna, salmon. Just as if there's no reason not to do it. And there's every reason not to do it. But you know what? Almost to the point of just throwing my hands up and saying, well, you know what? There is no reason not to do it. Just do it. Because we're so far out of control now, I don't even know if we can stop it. Honest to God, I mean, I feel that distraught. It's part of the reason why I'm like, I'm done. I'm done trying to help people figure it out, because people just, they're just doing it anyway. They're just barreling forward. Consumerism is rampant. It's everywhere. I mean, I walked into the store the other day and I'm like, oh my God, there's just everything everywhere for everyone at a moment's notice. Plastic is absolutely everywhere. I mean, I'm looking around all the time. I'm looking at plastic. It doesn't matter where I am in the world. I see plastic. And here's the weird thing too. You know, I'm a vegan, and you know I'm a vegan. That just means I eat plant-based. I don't eat any animal products. I haven't done that for I'm in my ninth year now. 8 years? 2011 to 19 is 8 years. Yes, I'm in my ninth year as a vegan. And it's been interesting. I've had a few friends say things to me like, well, you know, you still have leather shoes, or what about that leather handbag? Like, dude, don't go there. You know, I don't buy leather now, but I didn't throw away leather either. It didn't make any sense to me to throw away a leather purse when I became a vegan, or the current purse that I carry. It's a beautiful bag. It's like one of those super expensive bags. I won it in a raffle, okay? It's a leather purse. I won it. What am I going to do? Throw it away? Because the cow's already dead. I'm not buying anything new. In fact, you know what I like to do these days? I have returned to my super poor people roots. When I tell you super poor people, I'm telling you. Food stamps, WIC program, standing in line for government cheese. That's me. I lived in a car for a while. That's me. You know, yeah, you look at me now and you're like, oh, she never had that experience. Yes, I did. Lived in a car. Stood in line for government cheese. Ate that heinous USDA chicken in a can. It's more like glop in a can with gelatin all around. Oh my God, it smells like dog food when you open that can. It's a big can too. It's not like this little skinny can. It's a big can. Just, it's frustrating. I look around and I see all the plastic everywhere, and I see the leather everywhere, and I see people just acting like it doesn't matter. And so I'm kind of to the point where, like, I don't think people are going to change. I don't think they will. And I feel like at some point, I seriously look at my little grandchildren, and, you know, they range in age from twins that are 9 to a 6-year-old to a little girl who's almost 2. And I think there will be a day in their lives, not in my life, I'll be long gone, but I imagine there will be a day in their lives when the last tiger is in a zoo, the last elephant is in a zoo, the last elephant dies, right? We're already dealing with that. The last white rhinoceros, didn't it just die recently, or it's on its deathbed? I mean, haven't we seen extinctions, even us in our own lives? And then I'm like, well, maybe it just doesn't matter. There's no dinosaurs anymore either, and the earth still went on. You know, it's so weird. Like, I got all these conflicting, weird thoughts going through my head, and I don't really know how to manage it. I'm frustrated. I'm a little bit scared. I'm distraught. Climate change is freaking me out in a really big way. Let's go see that one article. I didn't read this one, but let's go see. Oh, what climate tipping points should we be looking out for? Let's see what this one is. This came out in July of 2014, so this is kind of a dated. This is interesting because it's old. So we'll have some perspective on it, won't we, because it's 5 years ago now. This was written by Andrew Gilkson. He's an earth and paleoclimate scientist with Australian National University. Disclosure statement says he does not work for, consult on, shares in, blah, 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 the same stuff before. So he doesn't have any disclosures he needed to make. He says the concept of a tipping point, a threshold beyond which systems shift to a new state, is becoming a familiar one in discussions of the climate. I love this because it's 5 years old. Lots happened in the last 5 years. Examples of tipping points are everywhere: a glass falling off of a table upon tilting, a bacterial population hitting a level where it pushes your body into fever, the boiling point of water, or a cube of ice being thrown into warm water where it rapidly melts. The ice cube is a poignant example because scientists now fear that West Antarctica's ice sheets are also heading towards irreversible melting. Oh my gosh, this is great because it's 5 years old and we've seen it. Likewise, the recent discovery of deep canyons beneath the Greenland ice sheet raises concerns regarding its stability. The history of the atmosphere, oceans, and ice caps indicates that once changes in the energy level, which drive either warming or cooling, reach a critical threshold, irreversible tipping points ensue. An example is a process called the albedo flip, where a small amount of melting creates a film of water on top of the ice. You guys know what albedo is. I know you know what it is. It's that phenomenon where black or dark material, whether it's asphalt or clothing or wood, absorbs heat, and light or white material like snow or ice or cement reflects light and heat. The water absorbs infrared radiation and melts more ice, leading to runaway melting of ice sheet. The opposite process occurs where the freezing of water results in reflection of radiation to space, leading to cooling and freezing of more water. Other examples are abrupt warming episodes during glacial states termed interstadials. For example, the Dansgaard-Oeschger warming cycles, which occurred during the last glacial period about 100,000 and 20,000 years ago, which caused large parts of the North Atlantic Ocean to undergo temperature changes of several degrees Celsius within short periods. Other examples are points at which a glacial state ends abruptly to be replaced by a rapid glacial termination. Okay, so, you know, this is kind of scientific, but it's kind of cool because if you go look at this, there's some graphs and pictures in here that are really cool. They help you understand and see and visualize what the author is talking about. He says an increase in global temperatures can lead to a threshold representing the culmination and synergy of multiple processes, such as the release of methane from permafrost or polar ocean sediments, retreating sea ice and ice sheets, warming oceans, collapse of ocean current systems, such as the North Atlantic thermohaline current, and, not least, large-scale fires. Wow. 5 years ago. 5 years ago, guys. Large-scale fires. I would say that most of these really big, scary, freaky fires, I mean, a lot of them have just been out of control in the last several years. A major consequence of warming of ice sheets is the increase in supply of cold, fresh, melt water to adjacent oceans, such as the abrupt cooling of the North Atlantic Ocean, including rapid freezing events, stadials is what they call those, as represented by the Younger Dryas event of 12,900 to 11,700 years ago, or the rapid melting of the Laurentian ice cap about 8,500 years ago, and related abrupt cooling events in Europe and North America. You know, I can't help myself to ask this question. I wonder, you know, so many people are like, oh, and I just like the warm weather. I hate the cold weather. Cold weather bugs me. I'm saying that like that because I say that. I don't want to live in the cold. I don't want to go to Reno. It's snowy there. I wonder if people would be more apt to be worried about climate change if the earth was getting colder. I mean, I'm just curious. If climate change meant, hey, in 10 years, it's going to be 5 degrees, 10 degrees, 25 degrees cooler everywhere, would people be going, oh, heck no. Oh, no, no, no. I'm just curious. I wonder, because, I mean, do we kind of all think that warmer is better? Isn't that funny? When you see vacation pictures, it always shows a warm, inviting beach with chairs. It doesn't show a Brookings beach, right? Because that's kind of a cool beach. No, it shows Ecuador, shows Southern California, Florida, Hawaii. Interesting. Anyway, they've got some satellite images in there, which is fascinating. It shows the ice remaining. It shows melting. It's pretty interesting. I really want you to go check this out. It's theconversation.com. What climate tipping points should we be looking out for? And thanks again for being here with us on KCIW, the Ocean Mist Power Hour. We're on KCIW 100.7 FM on your radio dial, and anywhere in the world, everywhere in the world, perhaps even intergalactically. That's right. That's what I'm talking about if you're on the podcast. The question is whether the post-18th century global warming trend may culminate in a major tipping point or, alternatively, is represented by an increase in disparate extreme weather events, as are currently occurring around the world. Remember, it's 5 years ago. What kind of extreme weather events have we been seeing increasing in the last 5 years? Hurricanes, tsunamis related to earthquakes, fires, tornadoes, all kinds of weird stuff. A potential indicator of such tipping point may be represented by a collapse of the North Atlantic thermal circulation, which would lead to a sharp, albeit transient, temperature drop in the North Atlantic, North America, and Western Europe. Evidence for a weakening of the North Atlantic deep water circulation by about 30% between 1957 and 2004 has been reported in Nature, as well as by other researchers. Now, Nature is a journal, and you can go click on that if you want to. It's the journal Nature. The question of tipping points is of critical importance since it affects future climate projections and adaptation plans. In this regard, the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report leaves the question of tipping points open. And you know what? If you have not read an IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, you can go click one here and read the one from 5 years ago. It'd be interesting to compare and contrast that with the current report. The crucial question. So how likely is the current climate change trend to reach a tipping point? And if so, what magnitude and on what time scale? General circulation climate models, which attempt to delineate overall future climate trends, are limited in their capacity to predict the precise timing, location, and magnitude of abrupt climate and weather events with confidence. Since the 19th century, the rise in the energy level of the atmosphere has reached a level of more than 3 degrees Celsius when the masking effects of sulfur aerosols are discounted. This degree of temperature rise is just under the energy rise level associated with the last glacial termination between about 16,000 and 10,000 years ago. The atmosphere-ocean system continued to warm following the peak El Niño event of 1998. Most of the warming occurred in the oceans, whose mean temperature has risen by about 0.3 Celsius since 1950. The current rise in atmospheric CO2 of about 2 parts per million of CO2 per year, reaching 401.85 parts per million at the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii in May 2014, exceeds rates observed in the geologic record of the last 65 million years. Wow. This is why I get freaked out. I'm like, the Earth has been here for hundreds of millions of years. Who knows how long it's been here? They talk about billions and this and that, and we're all so little. We're so little. We're so minute. We're such little pesky mosquitoes and gnats, us, the humans. We're like gnats on the planet, and we have that much lifespan compared to the planet. We're like, boom, done, gone, just like that. But guess what? We're taking the planet down with us. There is a part of me that almost wants to just go like, yeah, let's burn out in glory, man. Like, we're taking it down anyway. Let's go. More plastic, more leather, more meat. Come on. Come on. That's freaky, isn't it? That's some freaky stuff right there. An atmospheric CO2 level of 400 parts per million is estimated for the Miocene about 16 million years ago, when mean temperatures have reached 3 to 4 degrees Celsius above those of pre-industrial temperatures. Economically available fossil fuel reserves, if used, are capable of returning the atmosphere to tropical state, such as existed during the early to mid-Eocene prior to the formation of the Antarctic ice sheet about 32 million years ago. See, and then all of us are like, oh, the tropical state? The atmosphere to a tropical state? That kind of sounds good. Don't we think like, oh yeah, I live in Brookings and 80 degrees year round. Well, what does that mean for the rest of the world? And where are the people there going to go? Like, let's see, if you're already weirded out about brown people, and there's a lot of brown people in the middle sections of the earth, and they can't live there anymore, they might have to move somewhere. Don't think your walls are going to be big enough to keep those people out when they're fighting for their lives and the lives of their kids. Crazy. The evidence indicates that since the mid-1980s, the Earth is shifting from a climate state that favored land cultivation since about 7,000 years ago to a climate state characterized by mean global temperatures about 2 to 3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. At this level, extreme weather events would render large parts of the continents unsuitable for agriculture. The accelerated melting of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets could lead to conditions akin to those of the Pliocene before 2.6 million years ago, when sea levels were between 5 and 40 meters higher than at present, as estimated by the U.S. Geological Survey. The evidence indicates that climate may be tracking toward or is already crossing tipping points whose precise nature and timing remain undefined, depending on the extent to which ice sheet melting is retarded due to hysteresis. I don't even know what that means. Don't even know what the word hysteresis means here. Let's see if we can look it up. H-Y-S-T-E-R-I-S. Oh, hysteresis definition. Okay, let's see what the word hysteresis means. Wikipedia. Hysteresis is the dependence of the state on a system of its history. For example, no, we're not talking about a state like a politics state. Okay, so it's like a state of being. For example, a magnet may have more than one possible magnetic moment in any given magnetic field, depending on how the field changed in the past. Okay, here's another definition. Hysteresis definition is, yeah, see, like, this is what I do, guys. If I don't know something, I look it up. Do you do that? I hope you do. It is a retardation of an effect when the forces acting upon a body are changed, as if from viscosity or internal friction, especially a lagging in the values of resulting magnetization in a magnetic material such as iron due to a changing magnetizing force. Okay, cool. So now we know what hysteresis is. Let's come back here and see the increase in frequency and intensity of extreme weather events around the globe may represent a shift in state. Remember, that's what hysteresis is. A shift in state of the atmosphere-ocean system. There is no alternative to a global effort at deep cuts of carbon emissions coupled with a fast-tracked CO2 sequestration. As Professor Joachim Schellenhuber, Germany's climate advisor and director of the Potsdam Climate Institute, has said, we're simply talking about the very life support system of this planet. That's pretty amazing. Wow. You know, thanks for being here with me on the Ocean Mist Power Hour as we wind down the Ocean Mist Power Hour. It's been an awful lot of fun. We've got a few episodes left. We'll probably talk about climate change again. We'll for sure talk about nutrition again. I might branch out into some new topics. I for sure will branch out into some new topics as we call it a day on this little journey of learning how to be and do radio, which has really been fun. I want to encourage you, if you haven't done a radio program, get in here. Do one. It's a lot of fun. People want to hear what you have to say. You have a message. You have a unique voice. Maybe you have rants in you like I do. Man, I'm telling you what, I was on a rant today. I was on a rant and roll. I was on a rant and roll. And I just want you to know you could have some fun maybe doing a radio show. It's a lot of fun. Well, thank you again for being here on the Ocean Mist Power Hour. Enjoyed having you with us. We'll be back again soon with another episode. And thanks for tuning in to KCIW 100.7 FM on your radio dial. Take care now. Bye-bye.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.